October 22nd, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KB0S, and this week I've been, I had tree trimming done in my yard, had to take all my antennas down and put them all back up, but I've been reading a lot about how to communicate between different programs running in a system and different software strategies that are being used today. So I am making some headway there, but nothing on in code yet. So that's it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. I hope everyone can hear me. I've been working on the magnetometer-related things.
User entered your channel.
And variously trying to get to the end of my to-do list. Otherwise, just kind of looking after the home fires here and working on household things. So whoever's next.
Okay, thank you, Dave. And next on the list, we have Mike, AAAK, shown as recording and away. Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak art sessions to tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have Nathan, N2NAF. Go ahead, Nathan.
Hi, Dave and the group. Really nice to hear you this week. Things are going fine here. Had another week of teaching. We had an open house here at the University of Scranton on Sunday. So I was showing off some simpler software-defined radios. I showed off the classic RTL SDR radio, and I also showed off a Red Pitaya operating in a spectrum analyzer mode. So that was quite fun. I also did get a grant proposal submitted to the NSF this past week to support the HAMSI workshop. So that is still in process, and hopefully they will think favorably on us and give us some money to support the meeting
channel.
Again. W2NF, back to group.
Thanks, Nathan, and sounds like an exciting week. Next on the list, we have Rick. W2GPS. Go ahead, Rick. Well, Rick, we got a light, but not any voice. Are you trying? Okay, next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay, Dave, good evening. Good evening to everyone on the list. Been busy, been working on schematic capture for the receiver, and a little bit of a learning curve. But I think I'm over that now and started to building library parts, and we'll get started on the actual schematic here. I've identified a few components to use an SPI interface to drive the relays on the board, so making good progress. Back to the group.
Fine business, Tom. And next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. You made it.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Dave. And thanks for running the show again, as usual, doing a great job. So this week, I've been working some on the LCC, Local Command and Control Protocol, between the single board computer and the data engine, as well as some schematic capture things, trying to help Tom get up to speed fast. He seems to be learning fast, so that's good. And by the way, Tom, per your previous email, if you want to delete something out of the cache, just go in and delete all those instances of the part off your schematic, and then you do the pull down menu and you say clean up cache, and it will remove everything in your cache that is not actually placed on your schematic somewhere. So that might be a little bit of a helpful cleanup rather than having to start over again. Anyway, I think that's about it. Looking forward to Dan coming out and visiting toward the end of the week. And other than that, back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. Next on the list is Dan, M4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Dan, no audio,
I'm getting
Dan.
A light, but no audio.
Okay, should be better now.
Much better.
Okay, sorry about that. Good evening, Dave, and hello, everyone. Continuing on down the journey of Lin HPSDR and not succeeding very well with it. I have it up and running. I also actually ran it on my everyday Linux box a few days ago, and it doesn't run very well on that either. Using the very same equipment as the everyday Linux box, except in Windows, I can get it to run pretty well with HDSDR, which didn't surprise me. But anyway, I don't know what the solution is. I will bring my N2 when I go to Phoenix, and we can mess around with it there. I do want to look at it with Wireshark, although I think it's really a sound system problem that's causing the difficulty. And doing a little bit of research on Pulse Audio, I guess what I found out was a rather disturbing fault in that is, fact, and that is that all of the sampling is reduced down to 8 bits, I guess, through some sort of sampling system. And that's kind of how Pulse Audio manages to push things around your box. So anyway, not a lot of progress, and back to you, Dave.
Well, Dan, I want to let you know I'm running a version of Lin HPSDR with my Hermes, and it seems to be working fine. I just did an app, a git pull with the latest version yesterday, and it seems to be working okay. I have not tried it on my N2, so maybe I'll do that this week.
Yeah, give it a shot. I actually compiled mine from source. I didn't use the package, so maybe that's another option. I could just install the package rather than compile it from source. I think that'll work fairly well on the N2.
The instances I've done, I've compiled from the GitHub account, so I go through the whole process. But I'll give it a try on N2 and let you know next week how I do.
Okay, is your IQ2 still up and running?
No, it isn't. I had that voltage problem, and I haven't had a chance to work on it yet.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah, and Dave and Dan, this is Nathaniel. I mentioned last week I was also playing around with Lin HPSDR, and I did get it to work this week on Ubuntu using the latest version on the GitHub with the new install instructions. And I got it to run Friday afternoon and connected it to the active antenna we now have up at the University of Scranton. And it seems to be working okay, but I was using it on a rather beefy laptop and not on an Odroid.
Okay, well, the Linux box that I have is actually pretty powerful. It's the most powerful computer I've ever built, and I built a lot of them over the years, but it still doesn't handle things very well. And again, that one is also compiled from source, and it's using the two-step compile, which is compiling the WDSP source and then using that as a library to compile in HPSDR. So I'll do a little bit more monkeying around with it and see if I can make things better.
That sounds good. I still have to play around with it a bit more. I'm actually going to put a student on that soon because I haven't really tested it very well with the audio. It just got it up and running. It seemed to work, but we haven't given it real thorough testing yet.
Okay, well, the other thing I did is I actually am using a local AM station as my code, as my source. So for RF, so maybe that's an issue as well.
Dan, there is another option. If you don't have it come out of your computer, you can actually plug your earphones directly into the radio, and that should give you a non-pulsed version of what the radio is hearing.
Yeah, that's true. I tried that, and it's the very same issue. And what it is, it's I get a very nice display, which I think is pretty accurate. What I do not get is good audio. I get kind of a really distorted, gravelly audio, like something is not sampling correctly.
Okay, well, I'm not sure what that is. So that brings us to the end of the list. So we're open for general discussion.
Well, I'll start it off. First, I want to thank Dave Witten for posting about his successes or progress with the magnetometer so far to the list. And I know Scotty had some ideas about testing it, so maybe we can talk about that for a little bit.
I think Dave and Scotty went to sleep.
Well, I'm still here.
So am I.
So, go ahead, Dave.
Well, I just didn't have a whole lot to say right there. I appreciate the encouragement, but didn't know what to say next.
Well, Nathaniel, what kind of interface do you think your testers are going to want to have on the magnetometer? And by the way, before we get too far down the road, Rick, do you have your audio fixed yet?
I don't know. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
What? Really? Can you?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay. I guess I can say something then.
Go ahead, Rick.
Let's see. Well, I'm just got my new ham shack, my rebuilt ham shack with a brand new computer that I built and everything working. And I said, I'm going to run it from here instead of down in my lab. It's much more comfortable. And I said, I wonder if I can find a microphone. I wonder if I can find a place to plug it in. I wonder if I can configure it. So here we are. I spent last week at the AMSAT symposium, first symposium of the year for me. Very interesting. There may be some people I met there and some things that they want to do that are crossovers into this project, but I'll just let that stew for a little bit before I bring anything up. I did get a little confused over the last week or two with some feedback regarding where we really want to go with the GPS disciplined oscillator board. I had started working on it and did some feasibility studies with 3D modeling and got a little bit of feedback, but it caused me to stop work for a while till we figured out what was going on. And then I noticed some interesting conversations going on about timestamps and the rollover, and seems like everybody has finally figured out what I said about a month ago about what we should be doing with timestamps, but that's okay. So I'm a little confused as to what I should be doing right now, but I think I'm going to go back and continue work on the schematic and preliminary layouts, just feasibility stuff for the disciplined oscillator, and try to figure out where we really want to go with that. So that's what I have for today.
So Rick, when you're saying that people finally got caught up with the timestamping that you talked about a month ago, is that what exactly do you mean? I know I've been reading all of the timestamp conversations, but which part do you mean specifically?
Well, I was concerned that the early specs insisted on using either Unix time or NTP time, but time which would roll over in the 2036, I think, time frame. And I'm in that business, and I've seen what happens when you don't plan ahead. I was not happy with 32-bit numbers representing time. I see a number of people have come to the realization that 64-bit time makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's good. What about the comment? I saw a comment today where someone said, what about 128-bit time? What do you think about that?
I haven't thought about that at all. But it did cross my mind when thinking about the rollover that somebody might, that there's more than one way to represent fractional seconds. And that becomes an entirely different problem. That is to say, if you represent them as real numbers, then as fractional real numbers, then you can't actually represent time the way you think you can, because so it's better to represent, in my opinion, it's better to represent integer versions of something, whether it's nanoseconds or picoseconds. Now, nanoseconds are pretty hot stuff these days, but if you want to plan ahead, you might want to do integer picoseconds. Now, let's see. 128 bits would do integer picoseconds, I think, and still give us a rollover way out into the future. So that might be cool.
Okay, so, that's interesting. Go ahead. Go ahead, Scotty.
So I was going to ask, what do you think, Rick, of the scheme they're actually going to use? Is the units of time in our timestamp are going to be in units of the sample rate? So if we're going in 122.88 nanoseconds or megahertz, then it'll be in units of one cycle at that frequency. Is that reasonable to do?
The GPS disciplined oscillator currently has no idea what that frequency is. So no, it might be difficult. I got to think about that, but no, that might be tricky.
Yeah, well,
the idea. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was thinking there's an FPGA that actually is probably going to apply the timestamps, and so it can take some kind of a time indication like pulse per second and count off system clocks from that.
Well, you can do that. You still need to know the rest of the date and time calendar, which is provided by the GPSDO. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. I got to give that a little more thought.
The reason they're doing that is that's what the MIT Digital RF software does. So they use that for running the ionospheric radar systems up at the Haystack Observatory.
Well, that suggests a new train of thought for me. I assume if I called Phil up at Haystack, he could fill me in on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's his group is the one that's advocating for this scheme.
And in theory, I don't have a problem with it. It's just I hadn't thought of it. So good thing I logged on tonight for a change.
Yeah, that would be Phil requesting that, right, Nathaniel?
Yeah, that's right. I think their thinking is that it's a lot easier to do searches within the data if you're just indexing off of the sample rate. It makes that searching and indexing much easier.
I'm okay with it in theory. I need to get some more information from him on what they're doing, but yeah, I think we can manage that. I'm just not sure what implications, if any, that has on the GPSDO design.
I guess the strange thing is if you have a system where you potentially have different sample rates at different times, it's not going to be uniform, time indexing scheme.
Well, my experience, and it's limited, is with the projects on the other hill at Haystack. I'm part of the VLBI community up there, and they record data in a similar way at 16 giga samples per second.
So, Nathaniel, if we were to do a real-time reporting of so to the nearest so many nanoseconds for the channel zero, because we've already made the restriction, we're going to report the timestamp before a channel zero sample. Wouldn't, if we have a fixed packet size of 8K, wouldn't the sequence number be usable as a time calculator in units of the sample rate?
I would think so. I mean, as long as you have some way of translating all that information. Yeah, you have that in the metadata. It should be fine.
So maybe we get the best of both worlds. If we have a sequence number and we have a timestamp within that packet and the packets are all fixed size, then you have a way to link the real time in nanoseconds to the a particular sample, and then you can go in multiples of the sample rate from there by calculation.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, we need to run this by Bill, and so maybe it'd be good to have another conference call like we had, only have Rick on it this time, being much more knowledgeable about these things than I am.
Yeah, I think that would be nice. And it wasn't mentioned in the original call-up, but just so people know, there was a conference call earlier this week based on what Bill Engelke called together. And we had people online, including Scotty, Bill, Phil, and Ryan Voltz from the MIT Haystack group, talking about all of these timestamping schemes.
Yeah, so it would be good if you have time, Rick, to join in one of those conference calls. I think I'll suggest that Bill set one up again and review some of the things that we talked about, because we were kind of flailing around a bit.
I'll make time.
Okay, thanks. He unfortunately, apparently, Bill has a conflict for Monday night, so he can't be here. So I'll have to get with him by email and see if he wants to set another thing up.
Say, Scotty, I have a question about Bill. He sent me a whole bunch of files as a data dump and said, please put these on the website. So I'm not sure exactly what they were and where they go. Some of them obviously go into the document files. Some of them were past versions. Do you have any knowledge of what he's doing?
Yeah, he's trying to include some of the host functionality that he's written up. Are they in the format of the files that I noticed the files themselves are in the right format. Are the file names what we had talked about?
They're similar to the naming before, but it was sort of like he sent them to me and said, put these up, but he didn't say exactly where. And one of which he sent is a large M4 file, which appears to be an audio format, but it doesn't have audio in it. So I assume it's an IAQ data stream.
Okay, it's not a video file, not an MP4 format?
Well, when I tried it with any of my players, it didn't play.
Okay, yeah, you might query him, because I'm not sure. All I knew that he had some files that he wanted to be put up in the document area, and I thought they were updates of current files that were there. So what he wanted you to do is move the old files to the old directory and then put these in as the new ones. But, of course, it had to be named the exact same thing, just with a different version number for you to know what's what.
Well, I think it's close to that. I just, he assumed I knew what was going on, and I was a little leery, so I have not posted them up there yet. But I was planning to wait for the next one of these sessions and ask a question. Also, if that other file, where would we want to put it? In the documents, or should we make a separate space for video files that are not things like the conference recordings?
Yeah, so if it's just like a sample audio file, then we ought to have another directory for it, I think, because that the top directory seems to be for specifications and things like that. In fact, it's getting so full, I'm kind of wondering if we shouldn't be breaking it into some subdirectories pretty soon here.
Well, we can do that, and it's not that hard to make links to the current version and then have a way that you could access old versions if necessary.
So is there a way that you can, we could put these all in GitHub, say, and then have links to that, or is that too complicated?
That's not too complicated, but the structure, that would be one way to do it. And that's particularly if you want them archived in a sequence order, and who uploads them. And that, does Bill not have the ability to upload to that directory?
No, he doesn't. That's why he's asking you. So, but every link to GitHub I've ever seen just dumps you in the root directory, and you have to figure out what all the subdirectories mean. And we were trying to stay away from that as long as we could.
Well, you can go to a specific subdirectory. Let me look into it, and maybe I'll come back with a suggestion.
Okay, sounds good. Simplification is always a good thing if we can do it.
GitHub also involves a lot of versioning as well as just the directory structure that you're presented with. And I'm not an expert on it, but there's a lot more to it than just, like an FTP dump up there.
Yes, that's true. And I can play with some of mine just to see how they work before we try to do it on the official websites.
Part of it may also, another concern might be the size of the files too. I'm not sure how big these files are that Bill sent. I know GitHub, I'm not sure what their limits are. I don't think they want it to be too huge. Zenodo has a 50 gigabyte per data set limit. That's another option.
So the way Bill sent it to me is he used his university box directory and then made me a download member, and so I downloaded it. It just so happens my university uses box too, so it was not a big deal.
Okay, that sounds good.
So how big was that M4 file?
I have to go look. It's not right in front of me at the moment.
Okay, well, getting back to the magnetometer then, Nathaniel, what do you think for as an interface to the, and how are these guys that are testing the magnetometer going to use the data? How are they going to collect it and aggregate it and process it and all that, do you know?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. So the first question we're testing is, or the first question I want to know is, what are we actually testing? Are we testing the magnetometer itself to know if the calibration is correct and the nanotesla values are correct, or are we testing the transport of the numbers? What part of the magnetometer are we up to testing?
Perhaps there's been some discussion that I'm not aware of, but not quite. I feel like I've picked up a book on the wrong page.
Okay, Dave. Where are we, Dave?
Well, I posted an email on the list that kind of summarized where I was with things, but essentially I can do much what I want with the data values. I can't vouch for what they mean, but it does seem to have some sort of responses that, you know, I mean, I pick it up and I turn it and the numbers change. But I can do anything I want with that then. I can send it to a web browser. I can, you know, manipulate it. I'm using C. I've got a little Go web socket daemon that works nicely. I can present it in a web page type presentation, or I can encapsulate that in some sort of an application that's, you know, more compiled. Whatever you please.
Okay, well, I guess the question, maybe we should talk to Hyomin about this, is where is the best way to, what is the best way to test it? So I think what you have right now, I think what we want to do is set it up in, I guess you have it set up in your yard somehow, but we want to set it up somewhere and actually have it take measurements over some period of time. And I think it'd be really nice if we could have it set up someplace that was co-located with another science grade calibrated magnetometer and see if the two magnetometers see essentially the same thing.
Well, so what we were talking about was at some point getting a possibility of a kit together that would duplicate what Dave's done so far using his experience. And but if we're going to deploy these in multiple places, then you got to be able to read them. So that was kind of the question that, I mean, my answer to all your questions, Nathaniel, was yes on all accounts. Yes, we want to be able to have remote site read them. And yes, we want to try and do some calibration. And yes, we want to try and see how consistent they are in reading. But I think before we can do calibration and consistency in reading, we have to be able to get multiple ones deployed that we can read. So it starts out with a kit, I think, but I think the kit's going to require the remote what you're working on, Dave, with the I2C extender, because you're going to want to put it out in the yard, like Nathaniel says, not right next to your computer. And then once that's working, then maybe we can get kind of a, I don't want to say, it's not like a kit we'd sell at Tapper. It's like a scientist kit, you know, an experienced guy's kit. You're going to have to know something to put it together, but it'll require a lot of help from you, Dave, to tell us what to buy and how to hook it up. And then after that, if we have the transport mechanism, then Hyomin can kind of figure out what we want to do with the data.
Okay. Nathaniel has me just a little further along than I truly am. I haven't got this out in my yard at this point because I haven't got the IQC extender working at this moment, though I'm working on that right now. Let's see, what my thinking was that once I got this all under, you know, in a sack so I could, you know, do what I wanted with it, I was going to make a small PC board, stick it up on something like OSH Park, which takes about, I think, 10 or 12 days. Once I know that that works, then, you know, make a parts list and let anybody who wants it make one. I know it's, you have your own preferred ways of doing PC boards, but that's something I can do with the tools I have at hand, and I have everything pretty much I need to do it easily.
Well, you know, Dave, if you made it into a PMOD interface, which is simply an I2C interface on the right pins, then it would plug right into the data engine when we get a data engine, and it would use flying leads to hook over to the Raspberry Pi parallel I/O port, because it's only like power, ground, clock, and data. It's only four pins. And then, you know, we might just end up being able to use your board as is.
Well, yeah, probably. But I've got a bunch of little things. I'm not very fond of flying leads, though I have quite a lot of them involved here. I'm mostly using the little quick interfaces that Spark Fun's promoting. And the PMOD interface is, I know it's simple, and I was thinking to put one on there, but I didn't, you know, I know it's trivial, but it's not one I'm familiar with. I'd have to look up what that's all about. It's not as widely, as common as I think it is, you know, amongst non-FPGA people. So I'd have to find out what those guys, what the pins are.
Okay, well, that means I need to get finishing up on the ICD for the data engine, which would give you the pin out of the connector.
Yeah, my thinking at this point is not about plugging it straight into the, I mean, you can plug it into the data engine, but right now, it's easy to plug it straight into the Raspberry Pi bus on the N2, and that's what I'm doing.
Okay, well, that's fine. If that works, that's fine. I was just trying to find an easy way to migrate to the data engine when it becomes available. Like if you could put, even if you just put another connector on there and ran the leads over, so you could plug it in either one on one side or the other, kind of thing.
I was thinking to do that. The trouble is nobody but you can write the data engine code. And I was trying to make something that we could do stuff in at least C or Python or something like that.
Yeah, well, there are actually lots of Renesas CPU boards, ARM type boards that have, well, ARM and non-ARM type boards that have PMOD connectors on them. Lots of single board computers, but I guess the actual PMOD connector, even though the pins are the same electrically, they're the same on a Raspberry Pi, they aren't arranged in a PMOD connector, so you have to have just a different pinout.
Yeah, I know. Oh, the PMOD's, you know, a world unto itself, but I've got tons of stuff that outputs, you know, ARM and non-ARM stuff that is doing what I'm doing right now. So either way, I don't care. I'll put a PMOD on it, and I just have to look on whatever their name, Diligent or whoever it is, find out what the pins look like.
Yeah, it's Diligent, and I'll put a link down here at the bottom. That would be really awesome, because then it would work on either, and so it would be something that as soon as the first DE rolls off the line, I can slap some FPGA code in there, and maybe we can get some data collection going right away with just some simple data.
Yeah, yeah. My CAD work is not likely to be elegant, but I think I can get this part done in either Eagle or KiCad or something. Certainly don't have time to learn ORCAD.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, the PMI connector is easy enough. If you get the six pins right, then it works, and we're in business.
Yeah, the thing is, I, you know, I can write C code and I can push this to user interfaces and things all day long, but I don't know anything about what goes on the data engine board. That's a whole nother universe.
Yeah, I think.
And the good news is, go ahead, Tom.
Oh, you go ahead, Scotty.
Just going to say the good news is you don't have to know what's going on. All you have to do is put that I2C port up there on a PMOD connector, and we'll take care of the rest.
Yeah, Dave, have you looked at the magnetometer ICD and the magnetometer requirements document on the Tangerine? It sounds like the kind of board you want to build is what's already defined in the document.
That's essentially what I was following, I believe. I hadn't looked back at it just in the last week or so, but yeah, I was going to try and make one that might be useful to someone for another project other than this as well.
Okay.
So the PMOD board, Tom, the PMOD board hangs off to the side over by the USB ports.
I understand that, but nobody puts PMOD ports on things except Digilit.
And Renesas, neither of which we're using.
And nobody uses Renesas except in Japan.
Oh, now that hurts. We use it excessively. We got roped into being a Renesas design house. So when there's a processor needed, we usually will try to use that one first. But we've used lots of different ones. We've used PSOX and PIX and lots of ones. But our preference these days is the Renesas ones. And that's kind of where we got familiar with PMODs, because they're all over their boards.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. It's silliness. But and all these, an I squared C is an I squared C. We're not using interrupt driven for any of this. And the thing is, my point is that I can read it with a trivial C program, pipe it to user interfaces, and do stuff. The data we're reading it at is the date. What we're reading at is so slow. But I just haven't. What I have not made work, for surely dumb reasons. Every time you work with I squared C, especially if you try to run it anywhere, it seems like everybody can't decide which pull-ups need to be in place or which ones don't, and exact values of them. There's always something that keeps it from working at first, and that's where I am right now.
Yeah, I'm with you. We had problems with I2C ports on the Renesas parts because we couldn't get the setup time and the hold times are adjustable in the parameter registers, and they didn't give us the software GUI did not give us the allowed range of setup and hold times that we needed. So we're having trouble getting just a simple I2C port to work.
Unfortunately, that's pretty common, I think.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm just trying to short circuit the next move of hardware, because the first use of the magnetometer is going to be on the Raspberry Pi or the M2, whichever. And with deployment, a dozen or so around on the East Coast. And then if we get the bugs worked out of that, then when the DE comes along, it'll be just another data source that's going to be incorporated into packets that go over to the host computer. So I wasn't expecting you to write any FPGA code, Dave.
Okay, please. I've got enough with just what I'm doing. And my abilities do not seem to be improving with age at this point.
Well, I think you're making great progress.
This all seems very, very basic, but I find myself doing the stupidest things and having to back up and finding I just put the semicolon in the wrong place.
Scotty, quick question. In the ICDs, we mentioned using 3.3 volt I2C on the board edge connectors, and I just wanted to reaffirm that's the choice of voltages we're going to use.
Yes, and we could make them 3 volt or 5 volt, but if they're going to go to the FPGA, I can't do 5 volt without translators, so I would rather make them just 3.3 volt and stick with that, just make them that standard.
Okay, the relay driver I2C interface that I need to use has to be 5 volts because it can't be 3.3 volts when driving a 5 volt relay. but I can put a 3.3 to 5 volt I2C translator on the receiver module to talk to the 5 volt I2C chip. I just need to know, you know, what voltage that translator user needs to talk to on the connector.
Can you use an open drain output so that you could run it on 3 volts and then run the relay on 5?
I've only, you know, almost all of the parts are SPI parts to drive relays. I've only been able to find a single part, and it has clamp diodes. Even though it's an open drain output, it has clamp diodes to VCC to prevent the device from latching up. And so a 5-volt relay forward biases and then burns out that clamp diode.
User entered your channel.
Okay, so I'm just a little concerned because the outbound, if I run a 5-volt channel on 3.3 volts, now your input will be fine. It'll just be it'll just degrade the noise margin on an active high input. But it's an I2C though, so that means there's going to be data coming back that's going to be 5 volts going into my FPGA, right?
No. I've found a 3.3 volt to 5 volt I2C translator. It's a TI chip. And I can put that on the receiver board so it talks 3.3 volt I2C on the connector and then talks 5 volt I2C to the receiver module chip that drives the relays.
Okay. I was trying to avoid using that chip. Instead, maybe use just a clamp diode instead. But if you've got a chip that does that and it's cheap and small, then way to go.
Yeah, it's an 8-pin chip and it's 37 cents.
Ooh, that's big bucks.
Yeah, well, that's the price when you buy a reel of 3,000.
Yeah, okay. I think we can handle it. Especially since the A to D is going to be like, what, 50 bucks?
Yeah, probably more, a little bit more, but pretty close to that. Any rate, I think I've got that figured out. I'll send you the list of weird, squirrely stuff I come up with, and you can give me the once over on it.
Okay, sounds great. So how are you feeling with ORCAD? Is it feeling okay or overwhelmed or too complicated? And I get your comment on the squirrely parts editor with moving pins around. It's been that way forever, and I just deal with it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I would grab pins, and I could move them down 1, 2, 10, or 500,000 pin positions, but not up even one.
If you grab one pin at a time, you can move it up and down. And the trick is to get the cursor next to the body of the part. But if you try to move more than one pin, you will never move it up in your lifetime.
Yeah, I found a few cases where you start moving it up and then suddenly mouse left right causes it to move instead of mouse up down. So the mouse changes its directionality mid drag.
Yeah, I'm sure this is fixed with version 19 or whatever, but you know how that goes.
Anyway, don't worry about it. I've got the big complicated parts built, so I've got the huge pin fields laid out already.
Okay, good. And all the properties look okay, and I mean they make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I left most of the analog ones, just left the pins marked as passive.
Yeah, and the only thing that marking the pins does is it allows the checker to do a double check. If you put the wrong thing on and leave two pins, an input pin marked as an output, then it'll give you a warning and complain. But if you make them passive, it basically doesn't check anything then.
Yeah, no problem. So I got the transformers, low pass filter relays, transorbs, ferrite inductors, a bunch of other parts done. So I'm getting close enough where I can actually start the schematic.
Okay, and the trick is make sure that the pin numbers match exactly the data sheet, because the CAD guy is going to lay out the footprint based upon the data sheet.
Okay, I found a couple of parameters that I have to add to the properties. One is capital M, lower F, lower R, and the other is capital M, lower F, lower R, space, capital P, capital N.
Right, those are the two of the ones in my list.
Okay, are there any others that I need to know about?
There's only five. There's vendor part number, manufacturer part number, and geometry dot height.
Okay, I've got three of them. I'll need to go figure out the precise alphanumerics for the vendor and vendor part number.
Yeah, it's capital V E N D O R space capital P N, and then capital V, little E-N-D-O-R. So those are the two. It should be in that list. Everything's in that list except the geometry.height one.
Okay, I'll take a look at it. I figured out the manufacturer and manufacturer part number and started adding that. So I ran the bill of materials generator and the format looks correct.
Yeah, what I found is you end up running the bill of material. And then if you see like a 0.1 or say 100 nanofarad capacitor with the same voltage and the same capacity and the same package size, and it's on two lines, that means you pick two different capacitors from two different libraries, and they vary from each other by one parameter, one property. And so they don't appear on the same line because they've got a different property between them. And also then when you run the bomb, you'll find if you find blanks where the vendor or vendor part number, one of the properties is supposed to be, then you'll know that you didn't put that on that part.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've got manufacturer data on the parts that I've created. I don't have vendor information. So I'm going to, do you need vendor information always, or do you have somebody who's good at tracking that stuff down?
Usually manufacturer part number is all I need, but I like to have, and my vendor is of default is DigiKey, and I'll use DigiKey first. If I can't find it there, I'll use Mouser. And if I can't find it there, then I go to a page called ECIA-authorized, and it is a clearinghouse for about a dozen different vendors from Avnet to Arrow, Richardson, a bunch of other ones. And they'll tell you who has stock and what stock they have. And so then you could pick one of those guys out. If you have a funky part that's not sold by anybody but say Richardson, then you can put that in.
Okay. When I get closer to the done, I'll send you the BOM and we can discuss any boo-boos.
Okay, sounds good. And I'll have our parts person go over it, and she'll go through and she'll check. And that's why she says, I don't want DigiKey parts, I don't care. But I always give her the DigiKey part anyway, because if I typo the manufacturer part, at least then she's got something to go on instead of a non-existent part number.
Okay. A couple of the parts are a little unusual. There are TDK and some others.
But does DigiKey carry them?
I don't know.
Because DigiKey does carry TDK, but when you get to things like Coilcraft or mini circuits, you can't buy those at DigiKey. You have to go directly to the manufacturer.
Yeah. I've got a couple of mini circuit parts in there, at least three. And then the analog devices parts, so far, the only place I found them is on the analog website.
Oh, okay, really? Well, could you buy quantity there or just samples?
You can buy quantity there.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Nona will scout it out and scrounge up places that you can buy stuff that you or I or normal mortals can't find.
Okay, I miss having a good parts person who kind of knew every rock there was to be turned over.
Yeah, it's really a benefit to have something like that.
Yeah, basically the Radar O'Reilly of the parts department.
Yep, exactly. Hey, I see David has joined us too. N1HAC.
Yeah, hello guys. I had problems with my car, so I got home late, but glad to be on the conversation. By the way, I'm a pretty good parts guy if you need to have something tracked down.
Okay, good. We might call on you when we get stuck. I should say we will call on you when we get stuck.
Sounds good.
Say, Scotty, I don't know if you've noticed, I've been adding video Tepper DCC videos to the website. The ones for 2019, only the Lightning Talks and Steve Bible's intro are done to this point, or are up on YouTube at this point. I also added videos for the DCC 2018, but absent the Lightning Talks. So that's what's up. There were relevant talks in both sessions to Tangerine SDR.
Yeah, I've been looking there. I haven't looked in the past few days, so it's Jason's kind of whittling away at them one by one. So did you say all the Lightning Talks are up now? And you got my corrections, right?
Yeah, I did get your corrections. The first Stephen Hamilton one of his balloon sites does not seem to be there. But the second one of his knife edge over a mountain is there.
Okay, and yeah. So I don't know why that's not there. I can drop him an email and find out.
Well, Jason's gone off doing other videos that have nothing to do with DCC for a while, so I assume he's doing that to keep his business going.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because DCC's been a while now, hasn't it?
Yeah, if you look at last year, he did DCC, and the last DCC videos he posted were in March of 2019.
Ooh, really? So might take him a while then.
Yeah, just depends on how anxious he is to post them.
Or how anxious we can impress upon him that we are.
Yeah, I think he posts based on how many hits he gets.
But how does he get a hit for something that's not there?
He doesn't, but he probably has an idea how many hits any particular content will get.
Yeah, it's just that the other than the lightning talks, I mean, there's not any content there, just the introductions, so that's not going to... Okay, well... Maybe you'll just drop him a line and friendly ask, you know, when does he expect?
Okay, I'll do that. I did find the, well, I didn't, I found the name of, in my email, but I didn't find the video that I downloaded, so I must have done it on one of my laptops upstairs. But it is an M4A file. And it says that it is a teleconference with MIT that goes over the specifics of how to do timestamping in RF digital or digital RF file formats.
Ooh, that would be interesting.
But when I tried playing it on my machine, I could not get... an actual video, so I'll do a little exploring. It might work in a web browser.
That might be the telecon we had earlier this week.
Yeah, I believe it was. And it's an M4A, which should be an MP4 format, but I'm not sure if it's got some other stuff or it's missing some stuff.
Will it play in VLC?
I tried it in VLC and it didn't work. So I'm going to try it again, and I may download it again off the site and see what's going on.
Yeah, that's really funny. If it is a conference, I think it is, it should have been recorded using the Zoom software.
So who posted it, Dave?
What was that?
It was probably recorded using the Zoom teleconference software.
Yeah, okay. And Scotty asked me who... posted it? What do you mean?
Yeah, where did you find it? Who put it up online?
So Bill sent it to me. He sent me a link to his University of Alabama box site, and he said download it from there. So I downloaded it after it appeared to all be there, and he had sent me another email saying I'll let you know when it's all there. But I can't, I mean, it was huge. So, but I think I did it on my other computer, not the ones I have here in my ham shack. So I'll find it, and if it doesn't work, I'll get another copy from Bill.
Okay, very good. Did you get a copy of the one that Jason did of that he took after DCC of me piecing together the mock-up of the tangerine?
Go to the tangerine homepage, and down at the bottom, under development, there you are.
Oh, there it is. I see. Oh, well, I guess I have to visit this page more often and pay attention.
Hey, it is all about our project.
Yeah, who would have thought?
This one I put on this page and not in the videos because it is more of a see what we're doing now kind of thing. I should probably stick a little thumbnail next to it, and it makes it more interesting.
Okay, it would have got my attention more probably, because I kind of whizzed by the top page going to the underneath pages. And oh, by the way, I wanted to announce on the list to everyone here that should congratulate Dave won the election for a board of directors. Dave's now on the Tapper board.
Congratulations, Dave.
Yep. It's what you get if you volunteer, you get elected.
Oh, that'll give us a chance to see you twice a year.
That's right.